You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey folks, this is Ken Corsini and you are listening to The Deal Farm. Hope you guys had a fantastic Christmas and a new year and you guys are off to the races here at the beginning of January. On this episode, right here at the beginning of the year, I thought it would be cool to take a peek inside of our business, Georgia Residential Partners, and specifically our acquisition side of the business. You know, a couple years ago, all of our acquisitions really came off of our MLS or HUD, and very few of them came direct from sellers. Where now our business has shifted and almost all of our business, all of our properties are acquired through through our marketing efforts and through direct sellers. And it's really changed the way we do business. And so over the last 2 years, we've had to develop an acquisition side of our business where we're sending out postcards and doing internet advertising, all sorts of different things to acquire properties. So we've had a girl with us now for about a year who's our acquisition manager. And I thought it'd be interesting just to do an interview with her so she could sort of talk through how our acquisition side of the business is run, sort of our philosophy, really the nuts and bolts of how we acquire properties in our business. And hopefully that's helpful for those folks who are starting out and trying to dial that in, figure out how do you acquire properties off market. So without further ado, here's my interview with Heather. All right, so I am here with Heather Schroyer, our acquisition manager. How are you doing, Heather?
Good, thank you.
Good, well, I am excited to do this quick interview with you. I know it's gonna sound a little silly, me asking you questions, but Heather's been with us for almost a year and she knows the acquisition side of our business inside and out. And I just thought it'd be really cool to take some time and kind of talk with her interview style of how she operates our acquisition side of the business. And especially for somebody that's just starting out that wants to get into sending out direct mail and screening for potential motivated sellers. What does it look like? What does it take? How do we approach it? I thought it'd be cool to just sort of take an inside glimpse into our business and how our acquisition manager runs it. So Heather, I appreciate you being willing to do this for us.
Absolutely.
As you know, Heather, most of our direct mail is geared towards absentee owners. Those are folks that don't live in their properties. A lot of them, in fact, are out of state. They have rental properties, or maybe they have a house that they couldn't sell, and so they turned it into a rental. For whatever reason, they own a property that they don't live in. And so we send a lot of direct mail to our absentee owners. So what do you find to be a common motivation for those folks that call in and say, yes, I've got a house I need to sell?
Yeah, really, they are just not wanting to be landlords anymore. They, you know, tried it out and realized that it's a lot of work and they just simply don't want to be landlords anymore is what they'll tell me. And they just want to get rid of the property.
So I guess some of them probably bought the property originally thinking, hey, this would be cool. I want to be an investor. Some of them probably did it by accident. Maybe they inherited a house or they couldn't sell their house. What do you find?
Yeah, absolutely. I was gonna say other times it's family members that maybe inherited a property and then thought, well, hey, maybe I'll, you know, try to rent it out, become the landlord. And they realize that it's a lot harder or they just simply don't know what to do with the property. So they'll call us.
And is it common that a lot of the folks that are responding to our marketing have an issue with their tenant, or maybe they've just evicted a tenant? Is there a common kind of thread there?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think they don't realize like how hard it is to find an actual good renter. And it's just, you know, very time consuming. If they're not paying, you know, then they have to foot the bill that month. And yeah, it's just, you know, it takes on a lot.
Yeah. So when, again, just sort of high level, you know, we're sending out direct mail in different forms and fashions. Most of our mail right now is directed towards absentee. We've got a couple other lists that we mail to. Those people get a postcard in the mail that's got a phone number on it. They call in, and typically it goes through through like a Ring Central or like a Pat Live, where somebody else is actually doing the intake and then putting it directly into our CRM. So when Heather gets in, she actually goes into the CRM, sees the new leads that have come in. And then what do you do, Heather, in terms of screening before you call? Do you you see the lead there sitting in our CRM. It's already, so the intake's sort of been done, or at least there's a voicemail there that they've left for us. What do you try to do before you reach back out to that lead?
Well, usually they have left an address, or hopefully they have. So at least can go ahead and kind of pull the comps, just do a quick search in FMLS, pull it up on Bing Maps just so I can see what I'm looking at. But I try not to spend too much time researching it, because if I get voicemail, you know, I just don't want to waste my time researching.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and especially if you've got a lot of leads coming in, you want to keep your time as productive as possible. So
right.
We've brought different people in before in the past that, you know, I that screened our leads for us. And sometimes it is easy to get bogged down trying to know everything about a property before you talk to the lead, which in my opinion can be a waste of time. It's better just get them on the phone and get the story as quick as you can. And
absolutely.
You know, like you said, at least pull it up on Bing Maps or something, or Google Maps or Street View, and just take a look at the house so you sort of have a context when you talk to them.
Right.
So what other information do you like to have before you call a lead?
Yeah, so I like to, you know, I need the address, obviously, so I can pull some comps. It's good to know number of bedrooms and bathrooms. You know, is it vacant or is it rented out? But most of that I find out once I actually talk to the person live.
Yeah, which leads me to my next question. So once you get that lead on the phone, do you have like a progression of questions that you ask them? What does that look like?
I do. I actually have a little cheat sheet just posted on my cork board above, and basically just asking, you know, the address if I don't already have that, number of beds, baths, is it vacant, is it rented? If it is rented, you know, how much? And then I try to kind of ask for, like, do they have a ballpark figure? You know, it's 50-50. Sometimes they'll say, you know, give me a price, and other times, you know, they want to see what I will offer.
Yeah. Do you ever ask them how much they owe on the property?
I do if they come out and say, you know, I'm just trying to get what I paid for it. Then I'll ask them that. But usually not right off the bat.
Yeah. It sort of ease into that conversation.
Right.
You know, gain some level of trust. But eventually you do kind of want to know where as much of their cards as they'll show you, I guess.
Right. Right.
And so as you're working kind of down through those questions, you're working inside of a CRM, right? So are you sort of inputting that information and sort of taking inventory, I guess, in the back of your mind, is this going to be a good lead or not?
Right, right. And when I make a decision, hey, this looks like a good one, we'll send out our field rep. You know, if I can't get a price from them, I'll start kind of listing off some of the lower end comps that I found, you know, listing off, you know, the exact address, when it sold. So they know that, you know, I'm getting this information from FMLS, and I'll kind of fill them out and see what their response is. Sometimes they'll come out and say, no, you're way off. Or other times they'll say, well, you know, I mean, they'll kind of shoot back. I was thinking more like 70 to 80. So there I get I come up with a number.
Yeah.
So I jot that down in my notes as well. And that kind of, you know, leads me, is this a good lead or do I need to move on?
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense. You're sort of throwing out some ballpark numbers, and I'm sure you're picking the lowest comps out there.
Right.
Just to see how they respond to that.
Yeah.
Like, hey guys, I'm seeing some sold for 30, one here sold for 40. Is that kind of what you were thinking? And then based on that response, you sort of kind of know where they stand.
Right.
You know, the other critical component to talking to a lead is understanding their motivation, obviously. And most of that motivation has to do with some source of pain, whether it's the mortgage or they've had an eviction or their wife wants them to sell this pain in the butt house, whatever it is.
Right.
You're trying to get to the bottom of that pain and then sort of press on it. What have you found to be some of those trigger points, you know, in talking to people?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just help them see the picture of, you know, what would happen if they don't sell, you know, what their life will kind of look at. You kind of, you know, get them talking. Or what would it, you know, on the flip side, what would it be like if they were to get rid of the house? You know, how that would, you know, make their life better. But, you know, more so just make it seem natural, not so scripted.
Right, right. And even when you're in person with somebody, it's always in any sort of sales environment, you know, you're really looking for, okay, where's the problem? Identifying their problem, making them feel a little bit of a pain where that problem is, and then turning around and offering them a solution of, well, man, I can help you with that problem that you're having, or, you know, we could solve that for you by X, Y, Z. And for us, in our business, the X, Y, and Z is, hey, we'll pay cash for your house. You don't have to deal with a real estate agent. You don't have to put it on the market. You don't have to parade a bunch of people through your house in hopes that somebody's going to put a legitimate offer on it. We take all that away by just buying the house as is. You walk away pain-free, and you don't have to deal with it anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's sort of our unique selling proposition to them, as opposed to like a real estate agent who's, you know, talking them into listing a property.
Right, where it could take months.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With us, well, hey, 5 days, we could close this thing if you wanted us to.
Mm-hmm.
So how quickly, when you get a motivated seller on the phone, are you able to determine if they're a real lead or not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, with throwing out the ballpark figure, you know, that's where I come in, or that's where I really figure out if this is a real lead or not, or if I should move forward with it. So from that point on, I'll, you know, go ahead and schedule an appointment, you know, and that really shows, are they real or not? So I'll go ahead and actually schedule an appointment for our field guy to meet him out there, or, you know, if it's vacant, you know, get the lockbox code.
So if you're in your conversation with them, you can tell you're sort of in the same ballpark in terms of pricing, even though they haven't necessarily thrown out a number, but you've thrown out some numbers, they've responded somewhat positively to that.
Right.
Then you're like, okay, well, yeah, we don't have a number yet. Let's go ahead and schedule our guy to get out there. But on the flip side, let's say you throw out a couple numbers. You're like, so there's some comps in the 30s. Here's a comp for 40. And their immediate reaction is what? No way. I paid 120 for it. There's no way I'm going to sell it for that amount. What do you do with that lead?
Well, I mean, I kind of will go over the comps with them again and say, you know, hey, it just boils down to numbers, and, you know, kind of point out the pain and motivation factors again, you know, kind of get, you know, show them reality of what's, you know, can it even appraise for that much? You know, just kind of go back to, you know, let us take this off your hands.
Yep. And I think it's important, especially for an acquisition manager in your position, to quickly identify, and I know you do a great job of this, quickly identify if it's a good lead or not a good lead. Because if it's not a good lead, you don't want to spin your wheels and spend too much time on the phone with them when you could be on the phone with somebody else. And two, you don't want to, you know, waste our field guy's time either by sending him on an appointment that'll never turn into anything.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, if they come back and, you know, they're wanting retail price, and I just let them know, well, I don't think we're a good fit for each other, you know, thank them for their time and, you know, move on.
Yeah. So I think that's an important part of this, is working the leads that are hot and then closing the door and quickly getting off the phone with the leads that you know aren't going to pan out. Now, that said, in our system, even the ones that don't seem all that hot, we don't throw those leads away, right? What do we do with most of those leads?
Right. We do a lot of follow-up. Yeah. You know, I'll call them back in, you know, depending on how our conversation went, could be anywhere from, you know, 2 weeks out, a month out, you know, and follow up with them. Hey, just checking in, wanted to follow up, see if you still have the house, you know, or, you know, kind of bring back, you know, are the renters, you know, still paying? Are they still in? Are they moving out? You know, just kind of touch base with them.
Yep. Yep. Well, and we even have a system too, where sometimes we'll go ahead and have an offer automatically sent to them in the mail, just so they have a physical offer that they can hold on to. And then if their situation changes in 2 or 3 or 4 months down the road, or maybe it's a year down the road, mm-hmm. something changes, they're willing to really drop their price. They've got an offer in hand and they can come back to us. They also go into like an email drip for us. We'll get into some of the follow-up later, but I want to stress that even though it's not a lead that's panning out today, it's still important to put them into some sort of drip funnel where you continue to follow up with them. Now, for the folks that we do have, you know, some level of rapport with, you feel like maybe there's an opportunity there, you start scheduling our guy to get out there. What other information are you getting from them about the property, especially once you feel like, okay, I've got a live one here, it sounds like there's mm-hmm. some opportunity, you dig in a little deeper, what information do you sort of dig out of them at that time?
Yeah, so at that time I start to, you know, ask about the condition of the property. You know, is there any, you know, known issues with the house that you're aware of? But you know, most likely try to ask, you know, get an idea of the condition of the property.
Yeah. And what would you say is the reality factor of the information they give us about the condition of the house?
Yeah, that's not realistic at all, which we typically find out after our field rep has gone out. They usually try to make it sound like it's this beautiful, amazing home. And what I found to be the best way to actually, you know, scale it down a little is I asked them to rate their house on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, 1 being, you know, tear down, to 10 being perfect move-in condition. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I gauge better when they give me, you know, when they can put it on the scale.
And that, and so what do most people say? I mean, I doubt anybody ever says 1, it's the worst house.
No.
Ever. What do most people
say? I mean, randomly, you know, someone will say, hey, it's a teardown. But I would say majority actually, you know, they make it sound like a 10, and then I ask them to put it on the scale of 1 to 10, and it's usually about, they'd say 6 or 7.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, they talk the house up, but then when they're asked to actually put a number on it, the number's typically lower.
Right. Then no one ever says a 10, so. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, and I mean, they know too, we're going to set up an appointment. Our guy's going to come out there. They're going to see the reality of the situation. So,
right.
I mean, don't waste our time or their time. Just give us, you know, the honest answer. And I'm sure that you stress to them too, hey, look, we'll buy the property regardless of the condition. That's what makes it so attractive to sell to us. We're not going to ask you for any repairs. That's a big selling point too, as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. We buy as is. You don't have to worry about fixing up if you were to put on the market.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, sometimes the uglier the better, in my opinion. I like taking ugly houses because nobody wants them, and usually there's good upside potential.
Right.
So once you've got one of these, a live wire, you feel good about the person you're talking to, you're ready to make an offer, how do those offers typically come down? I know every scenario is different, but how does that typically play out?
Yeah, most of the time I wait for our field rep to come back and kind of give us a detailed report. You know, that way I have more concrete information to come at them with, more leverage for what our price is on the house. You know, it needs this and that, needs new windows, or the roof looks like it hasn't been repaired. There's no updating. That gives me a little more leverage negotiating.
Absolutely.
Rather than just giving a blind offer.
Yes.
Occasionally, I guess we'll do that if it's like a hot house and I know there's several investors that are submitting an offer.
Yep. So, I mean, our field guy, how often is he actually meeting them out there versus just getting into the house and kind of inspecting it?
I would say it's about 50-50.
Okay.
You know, sometimes the seller will meet them out there, you know, to unlock the house, or sometimes there's a key just laying around. Usually you can tell too if, you know, there's a key hanging around, or, you know, the front door's just unlocked. You know, you can only imagine what condition it's in.
Right. And this is where different investors do it differently. Some investors insist on going out there themselves, meeting the person at the house, and then really doing that in-person sales job on them, which honestly, I think there's nothing wrong with. I think it's a great model. It seems like in our case, though, most of the time, because they're absentee owners, most of them aren't even around to meet us there. There's a tenant in place, or the house is vacant. And so our field guy's really just going there to inspect and give us a number, and then really most of the communication is just done between you and the seller over the phone.
Correct. And a lot of time the sellers are even, you know, they live out of state.
Yeah, right. So they're not even around. It might be just coordinating with the property manager to get into the property.
Correct.
So I like what you said too. So once our field guy comes back, he's got pictures, he's got information. You use that as leverage. I think that's key. You come back and say, hey man, you might not have been in the house for a little bit, but just want you to know your roof is toast. It needs to be replaced. You know, the HVAC is outdated. It's not working properly. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to drive down the price.
Absolutely.
You know, the other thing that you do that I really like in terms of pricing a property is even after you've talked to them and you've negotiated a little bit, you always come back and ask them, so is that your lowest price? And it's such a simple question, but how often do you ask that question and they'll actually come down on the price?
Surprisingly a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you just got to ask.
So even after you've had some banter back and forth, you've built this rapport, they've sort of given you an idea where they want to be. Even when you ask them, you know, what's can you come off anymore? What's your lowest price? They even still come down after that. And to the truth is, if they say, yes, I can come down a little bit more than that, or my lowest number is this, chances are they can come even farther than that, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They're never going to give you their lowest, you know, amount right off the bat.
Yeah. So part of this is an art form where you're feeling this seller out, you know, how much give is there? How much are they kind of shaky in the actual price? If they're not firm, then you just keep driving that price down as far as you can.
Right.
So is there like a formula that you use in terms of making offers, and what does that look like?
Yeah, so I will, you know, pull up comps, and Bing Maps helps with, you know, looking or finding true comps. Sometimes you can find, you know, brand new houses that aren't really a comp to your house. So that comes in handy. And then basically we'll just find the, you know, ARV, which is the after repaired value of what we think, you know, the house would be worth fixed up. And we kind of, you know, I back out 70% of that and then, you know, estimate amount of repairs just from talking to them. And that's where I kind of come up with my ballpark price.
Or the repairs from our field guy so far.
If I'm doing the, if I have the repairs from our field guy, yeah, then I just back out, you know, his estimate.
Yep. So again, this is a good distinction. Some of the time you're making offers after our field guy has looked at the property. And that's, you know, that's the ideal scenario, is that we've had a chance to look at it, we have a good number, and we make an offer based on our actual repair estimate, you know, and 70% of the ARV. But sometimes, it's like you said before, it's either a hot property that we need to make an offer on quick just to tie it up.
Yes.
Or it's a property we don't really care that much about. We know we're not going to keep. We're probably just going to wholesale it. And so you go ahead and throw a number on it, just go ahead and get the contract, and then we'll get our field guy out there whenever we can, sort of thing.
Right.
So our formula, especially for the houses that, you know, we're going to keep, is let's say it's $100,000 ARV, again, after repaired value. Say that's what the house is going to be worth when it's all fixed up. We take 70% of that, so take it down to 70,000, and then we subtract out repairs. So let's say the repairs are 20,000. So we would take 20 from that 70. So our offer price would be $50,000 with an anticipation of it being worth $100,000 after it's been fixed up. What do you do in terms of due diligence when you are negotiating a contract?
Typically, I put on, you know, I put in 21 days. I try to do the longest amount of due diligence to protect ourselves. And most of the time, the sellers surprisingly don't raise an eyebrow at that. So unless they bring it up, I just put on 21 days due diligence. Unless it's one of those properties that, you know, we're competing with other investors and it's a hot property, you know, we'll try to put on as few days as possible.
And so the purpose of our due diligence in our business is to see if we can wholesale it. Because we do, in our business, there's a little bit of both. We wholesale and we buy and do the fix and flip. So if we aren't sure it's a house that we want to necessarily buy, we're thinking, okay, we'll probably just wholesale this property. You want to get as much due diligence as you can, because it's the due diligence period that allows you to put it on the market and blast it out there to local investors to see if they want to buy it. And so Heather typically puts 21 days, which is 3 weeks. And so what happens if at the end of 3 weeks, we don't necessarily plan on buying the house and we haven't found a buyer for it yet? What do you do in that point in time?
At that time, you know, if we do have some interest in the property, but the price is too high, I'll try to negotiate, you know, the price down a little bit and say, it's just too much for us. We can't make it work at this price. They've already kind of got their hopes up. It's been 3 weeks. You know, at that point they're desperate, or, you know, they're eager to sell.
Yep. Yeah. It's so true that their mindset has sort of flipped into, hey, I'm going to sell this house. It's going to be great. Can't wait for it to close.
Yes. Yeah. They're more willing to come down in price.
Yep. Well, and in their mind, they've lost 3 weeks thinking they were going to close. And now you've come back and said, hey, I need to get this for $5,000 less.
I mean,
it's a pretty good percent of the time when they agree to that, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully that's not the case. I mean, you don't want to get a reputation for constantly, you know, changing.
Yeah. That's not our motto here. Yeah. So.
No, you want to, but you try to lock up a house, get 21 days due diligence, assuming that, okay, I'll have a buyer for this. Now, what about due diligence on houses that are hot? We know we're going to buy them. We're not going to wholesale them. What do you do with due diligence on those?
If we absolutely know we're going to buy them, I'll put, you know, I won't even put a due diligence day on there. As long as, you know, our field rep has gone out and seen it. Otherwise, if he hasn't been able to see it, I'll just put as low as, you know, 1 to 2 days due diligence.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Again, it's really up to us. It's our level, our motivation in buying the property. How bad do we want it? If we want it pretty bad and we know we're going to keep it in house and our field guys already looked at it, then yeah, there's no reason to have due diligence. We'll just proceed to close as quick as we can.
Right.
You know, I know with going after absentee owners, we end up getting a lot of houses on our contract that have tenants in place. What sort of scenarios has that played out for in our business? What are some of the issues with that?
Well, yeah, so I've learned early on to, you know, immediately request for, you know, rent rolls and a copy of their current lease agreement. That way, you know, up front, you know, are these people paying on, you know, are they paying on time? Are they current? You know, is there anything, you know, any stipulations in the lease agreement that you can kick them out if you needed to? So that's definitely key. If I hear they have a renter, I already, you know, I go ahead and request that.
And I know in our business, there's been a number of occasions, especially in the last year or so, where we've inherited tenants. We didn't do a really good job in the front end of vetting the tenant. And then you're stuck with just a deadbeat that you can't get out of the house. And so that is sort of a word of caution to folks that are going after absentee owners with tenants in place. Now, sometimes we've inherited amazing tenants as well. It's not always the case.
Right.
But it is so crucial that you vet the tenant as carefully as you can. You get all the paperwork. You make sure that there's a security deposit, prorated rent that comes to you at closing, all those things. And if there is a plan in place, which a lot of times there is a plan in place to get the tenant out of the house, sometimes it's before you close on the property. Sometimes it's after you close on the property. But if the plan is to get them out after you close on the property, then you have to cross your T's and dot your I's to make sure that that tenant is going to be out on the date that they say. And if they're not out, there's some governing document that, you know, you can take to court if you need to evict them.
Yeah, I would say the biggest red flag is if the tenant has no idea that the house is being sold. Usually doesn't pan out well.
Yeah. Not
but if they're aware and they're willing to let you in and inspect and, you know, you can briefly discuss with them, you know, it's usually okay.
Yeah. And especially if they let you in and they're willing to work with you, a lot of times you can negotiate even a new lease. We've done that in a lot of cases too.
Right. Where,
hey, we're going to be the new owners. We'd love to get you on a new 12-month lease. And if they're willing to do that, maybe even raise the rents in the process. We've done that as well. It's a great time, but all of this needs to be figured out before you close on a property. Is what are going to look like with this tenant after you buy the house?
Yes.
And if a tenant's not going to let you into the house to inspect, that's a red flag as well. We've run into that too.
Yes.
They won't let you in. If they're uncooperative,
then don't just buy it.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So again, our goal, or at least on the deals that we wholesale, is to get them sold within that 21-day due diligence. When do you typically turn over a contract to our marketing department, Heather?
Yeah, so once I have the contract fully signed by, you know, all parties, and our field rep has gone out and done a report on the property and he's taken some pictures, then I, you know, turn it over to our marketing department.
And for us, that's ASAP, right? I mean, as soon as we get a contract signed, we want to utilize every day of those 21 days to.
Absolutely. It's as soon as possible.
Yep. And so what does that look like? So let's say the marketing, it goes out, we blast it to a list, we get some interested buyers. And then this is where wholesaling is a little bit tricky, is now you've got a buyer that wants to get into the house and view it. How do we typically handle that? What does that look
like? The idealistic wholesaling house would be vacant and on a lockbox with a key for an investor to go look at. But that's not always the case. You know, sometimes there are renters in place and you have to give them 24 hours notice. Sometimes the seller's not even ready to, you know, inform the tenant that they're thinking of selling, which again, kind of is a red flag there. I try to get over to the marketing department, you know, day one on due diligence because we don't want to waste any days. And our, you know, if it's a super hot property or priced really well, then, I mean, we can get a contract in the next day or two. And then there's some that people go look at and, you know, we just don't, you know, we don't get an offer on it.
Yep. Well, and so what are some other issues that we run into after we get a contract?
I would say probably, yeah, access to the property.
Yep.
And it's usually when, you know, there's a tenant in place. They don't really have any motivation to let anybody in. They're the renters. They have no motivation at all to, you know, get this house sold. So it's usually trying to coordinate with them. And if you do have a time arranged, do they actually, you know, show up when they say they're going to show up and, you know, let someone in?
Yeah, that's definitely one of our headaches that we deal with on a pretty consistent basis. You know, the other problem I know that we deal with a lot is our sellers flaking out on us a little bit. I mean, even after you've verbally agreed, you've sent them a contract, sometimes they go dark or they don't send back the contract. Sometimes they sign the contract and then you still can't get a hold of them.
Yeah, there have been cases where I've gotten a contract signed and I've sent it out to marketing and, you know, we're trying to arrange an appointment with them and they're nowhere to be found or they've left the country and, you know, it's impossible for us to arrange an appointment.
Yeah. The worst is when they up and change their mind or all of a sudden they feel like, hey, I got a better offer over here, even though I signed a contract with these guys. I'm just going to pretend like that doesn't exist and I'm going to try to find another contract over here for more.
Right.
Run into that occasionally. Because the reality is, if you send a postcard to a list of absentee owners, they've probably got 10 more postcards from other investors who are also marketing or they're in the process of receiving those. So it's competitive and and they feel like, okay, you know, I'd like to get the best offer possible. And even after they've signed a contract, they might keep shopping, which, you know, you need to remind them that they can't do that.
Right.
Another issue that we occasionally run into is, you know, we'll get the 21-day due diligence on a property that, you know, we don't really intend on buying. Obviously, we're trying to wholesale it, but we can't get the property sold. I mean, that does happen on occasion where you lock one up, you think you can find a buyer for it, and at the end of the day, you just couldn't find a buyer for it. What do you do in those instances?
Usually in those cases, I would say one reason we couldn't sell it is because we couldn't get access to the property. So I usually try to talk to the seller and, you know, inform them, hey, we need more time. You know, I need to extend our due diligence. We didn't get enough access. You know, we couldn't access the property, you know, as we had wished.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, we just can't make it work at these numbers.
Oh yeah. Or that's a perfect time to, you know, yeah, we need to reduce the price.
We need to and maybe get us by an extra 10 days or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, Heather, you've been at this for about a year now. What do you like about being an acquisition manager? I'm just curious.
I enjoy talking to, you know, different people every day. You know, establishing a relationship with them, you know, enough so that they'll, you know, they become, you know, you gain their trust. Mm-hmm. And you know, they'll sometimes pick you over some other investor because they simply, you know, enjoy talking to you or felt more comfortable with you. So I would say that's probably like the best part of my job.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, and it's, I mean, every day for you, you come in and it's like a treasure hunt.
Right, every exactly. Day,
it's like you having to pick through all the weeds to find the diamonds that are in there.
Yeah, when you do find the diamonds, it's like the best day ever.
Yeah, it feels good to lock something down that's a really good deal. Well, and to that point, I mean, a lot of what you do is follow-up. I mean, you're following up with leads day in and day out. They're not all just brand new leads that you get to work. I mean, a big part of the job is continuing to kind of dig through those weeds to find those diamonds, even if they're old leads.
Right.
How important is follow-up, I guess, in our business?
Yeah, I would say it's crucial, you know, to our business. It's very rare that I'm going to talk to somebody, you know, one time and we have a contract. It's going to be, you know, several days that I talk to them. You know, it can extend out as far as weeks or months even before I actually get a signed contract back from them.
I can't harp on this enough. I mean, follow-up is what we've learned. It is the name of the game for acquisitions. It's very rare that you get a phone call from somebody, you immediately figure out a price, and then next thing you know, you're closing on it. I mean, what percentage would you say of our deals come through multiple touches over an extended period of time?
Yeah, I would say about half of our deals are, you know, ones that were extended follow-up.
Yeah, ones that got on sort of an email drip campaign where there's automatic emails coming to them. We're sending out slide aisles that are going directly to their voicemail. You know, Heather's working through the database, calling and following up with people, or even we even do like a yellow letter drip campaign where every 2 weeks or so they're getting a yellow letter from us where they're just getting dripped on all over the place. And eventually, I think they get tired of us or their situation changes, and that's when they call back and that's when it turns into a deal.
Yeah, I was gonna say, usually the situation changes. And even though they don't respond right away, they will mention, "Oh yeah, I've been meaning to call you back," or, "I did get your email or your voicemail. Sorry." So it's, they are still getting it. They're still listening to it, even if they aren't responding right away.
Yeah, that's right. So, what would you say to somebody who is just starting out in this business and they're starting to spend a little bit of money on marketing and they're getting some motivated seller leads in? What would you tell that person?
I would say just be patient, be consistent with your follow-up, and eventually you'll get a deal out of it.
Yeah, stay at it. That's sort of the theme too. A lot of the guys that we've interviewed on the show, how, the first deal took a while, took maybe even months, maybe even a year before they got that first deal. But then once they got the first deal under their belt, it's like the dominoes sort of start to fall. Then they
Yes.
get in a groove and the deals start coming. And a big part of that is just through follow-up. It's building a pipeline, like a funnel of deals that, eventually over time start turning into actual purchases.
Yes,
So I
it's like
think
a domino effect.
it is, yeah. I think that's great advice for anybody that's just starting out, is stick with it. Don't do it for a month and say it didn't work. You really got to do it for a handful of months, or even longer to get that first deal in a lot of cases. So Heather, thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate you joining us today, and I hope it's been helpful for those folks who are interested in putting together an acquisition model or a strategy in their business, or even if you're just on your own, just starting to send out some marketing, trying to acquire a deal here or a deal there. Hopefully, understanding sort of the dynamics of dealing with motivated seller has been helpful today. As always, feel free to check us out online at dealfarm.net. If you have a topic or a question you want to cover in a future episode, you can let us know online. And hey, it is the beginning of 2016, and we still have some t-shirts around. So if you guys want a free t-shirt, just subscribe through iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, and then tell us about it and give us your shirt size, your address, and I will send you out a t-shirt immediately. Thanks again for listening to The Deal Farm. I look forward to seeing you guys on the next episode. Take care.